Operation High Tide is a plan by the Christian far right that aims to essentially criminalize being trans in Singapore, such that anyone suspected of having gender identity disorder, as they like to call it, can be put in an asylum.
Hello and welcome to episode 45 of Let Them Eat Cake. My name is Jack. My co-hosts are John and Ace. Today, we are talking to two Singaporean activists involved in the LGBT movement in the country and actively working to counter the Christian far right within the country. We go into where these Christian groups get their money from, how they threaten the LGBT community there, and much more. But before that, let's get into some important headlines for everybody.
All right, so democracy updates. Recently, Russian elections kicked off on March 15th, closing on March 17th, resulting in Putin's overwhelming victory by 87% of the vote, which is the largest margin that he's ever won by, I believe. Fact check me. So there was protest votes that did happen. There's an infamous video of a woman pouring ink in a ballot box who immediately got arrested. People are writing in Navalny's name, but it's not really, you know, I don't know. Efforts were kind of pointless. There's a lot of video, especially in occupied Ukraine, of people basically getting brought their ballots, if it's like an old lady, or being brought to the ballot box with like armed soldiers. It's like, wow, that sure is democratic. It's for their safety and protection. They're just helping them to protect them to vote. So obviously ramping up to the election, opponents were jailed. There was rumors that one guy might run or something, and then they said that he couldn't. Alexei Navalny died, and all of it just accumulated in Putin consolidating power, similar to how Xi Jinping did in China. And then there was also an ISIS attack in Russia. We'll get more back. We'll wrap back around to that and stick more in like some of the democracy stuff that's going on. Portugal, the center-right political party, claims a minor victory in Portugal. But the candidate who's basically at the top of that coalition is pretty much representative of the far-right party. So a lot of people think that Portugal is going to have like this right-wing shift, but really the left has had, it's just the left losing their absolute majority. They still have a majority kind of thing going on there. It's just the coalitions, because the far right, because this is how parliamentary governments form, you know, they basically, you can spread your shit out. It just matters what coalition does what. So you really need to be really good to get an absolute majority in some of these parliamentary states. And Portugal's left wing lost that. So who knows what exactly that will bring in Portugal, if they'll be stricter on immigration, which is also something that we'll get into. Or I know the guy, he has some weird views, like it's something around abortion or LGBT stuff. So I don't think it's going to be that different in Portugal, but we'll have to see. And then Senegal, if you've been watching our streams that we do Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we've talked about Senegal a lot. I think I might have even talked about them last recording, because we do these so infrequently, it's hard to remember when I talked about it last. There's been an election crisis. I did talk about it last time, because I remember reading Macky Sall, right? So following up on that, they finally basically just were like, hey, it's happening. And the election is happening. Probably by this will be out, and it's already have happened, because it's going to happen on the 24th. We'll see what happens there. But obviously, there was a lot of back and forth. The Constitutional Council got involved, and Macky Sall kept saying he's not trying to hold on to power and stuff. But what's important here is that it's in this region where we saw all these coups happen. Senegal is technically, like, still, even though it's not really a Sahel state, it still is one of those states. It, like, borders them. It's affected by that. So if things kept going downhill, who knows, maybe the little alliance that we'll get more into would have expanded a little bit. So that's where in Africa, and I mentioned in Niger, the ruling military junta has accused the United States of being condescending and accusing the deal between Niger and the United States of being constitutionally illegal. Now, what kind of deal is that? What does this exactly mean? So basically, U.S. troops have a mission there. If you remember, there was a Angatanga, right?
Yeah, something like that.
In Niger, right?
I think it was, yeah.
Tongo. This is a famous time. What it was is they were put there during the Obama admin. And this is reflective of Obama's policy, is that he believed that he could just drone strike and put specialists everywhere. So Trump continued that policy because most of the time you do continue the predecessor's policy, especially in foreign policy. And so there has been a mission there. There has been a United States mission there. That's where this Tonga Tonga massacre happened. Not Tonga Tonga. I always think it's Tonga Tonga. It's Tonga Tonga. So that mission is basically what they're saying is constitutionally illegal. So there's been this kind of spat because obviously the United States doesn't like that the coups are happening. And you can say it's because their like imperialist power structure is dwindling, you know, or whatever you want to LARP with. But this coincides with Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso from forming a NATO-esque defensive cartel pact. It happened after you had ECOWAS, which we've talked about on the previous shows many times. This has been something we talk about for a few episodes now. ECOWAS basically said, we're going to invade you, which all things considered is just Nigeria saying that they're going to invade them. So they formed this defensive pact, and then they were saying that they were going to withdraw from ECOWAS. I think we even reported that they did withdraw, but it was just like a empty threat type thing, and immediately sanctions got dropped, and now they're still staying inside ECOWAS, which is, I think, kind of what I said at the beginning. I said, I don't think that they're going to, much is going to really change. Obviously, Russia is more pro the opposition that came in these countries, and you can look back on previous episodes to get more into Africa, but that's just one of many crises that is causing displacement in Africa. The EU just agreed to a 7.4 billion euro aid package to Egypt. And then this is anticipation of massive immigration flood from Sudan, because as you should know, if you watch us, the Janjaweed and Sudanese military are fighting. And then obviously there's the situation in Gaza where people are going to flood into Egypt, and Egypt doesn't really have the means. I mean, Egypt's economy has collapsed, which is why this aid package is so important. Largely negotiated by Giorgia Meloni, but this is like this is the EEZ, Turkey, Greece, Egypt, Libya, the EEZ zones. This is a big thing that's always been going on there. But obviously, Egypt and Libya basically drown people on the behalf of the European nations who are trying to escape their countries because of war or climate change or terrorism, things like that. And if the IDF does eventually push into Rafah, which is interesting because the United States gave a red line for once, and they're starting to show that they're serious about Rafah being a red line, which I'll get more into in a second. But the deal with Egypt basically is just to kill migrants, prevent migrants from coming to Europe. And then they also have Italy or Britain, they also have a thing with like Kenya or Rwanda. Well, they'll send migrants back to that location and stuff. So EU, human rights defenders, am I right? So staying in this area of the world, the United States and the European Union are now leading the charge for a lasting ceasefire in Gaza, some would say. Following the events like the Flower Massacre, Israel has slowly been leading support for their ongoing genocide in Gaza that's been masquerading as a special operation to oust Hamas militants. The easiest thing would have just been to let the aid trucks in. And like, that's the whole thing. When they started the aid drops with the vegetarian MREs that are totally halal, by the way, each of those cargo planes is like one truck of aid. Every drop is just like one truck of aid. So imagine if 30 trucks were able to get in. Just the fact that I'm sure, you know, most people have heard that, I mean, it was in the State of the Union speech. You should know that the United States is building a dock and it's going to take a while for it to get there. But like, that's undercutting Israel. That's a really big deal. And then Gantz, the opposition. Now, I want to be clear, when we talk about opposition in Israel, it's just like Naftali Bennett. They might be better than Netanyahu, but the status quo is not going to change. The apartheid will not stop, no matter what, no matter who's backed. And the United States will always be complacent in this, just like how they were with South Africa. Another aspect of this is we might be able to chalk it up to the polls and how many primary elections actually came out just to do a protest vote. So we had legendary turnouts, record high, legendary is a dumb word, record high turnouts in a lot of places, and they voted for uncommitted. And this might have put a lot of pressure on Biden. There's rumors that he was yelling at people after Michigan and things like that. So that might also have been part of the pressure to get across the message. But just everything culminating, I'm sure, has some effect. But one of those other big ones is not only, so Gantz, the opposition, he went behind Netanyahu's back, met with the United States and the UK, right? And when he got back, Netanyahu was like, there's only one prime minister of Israel. Like, how dare you do this? Blah, 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 blah. But it's funny because Netanyahu went behind Obama's back and started working with Republicans to oust Obama because of the Iran deal. So it's just funny coming from him of all people. Now, the other recent big thing, Chuck Schumer, who is the highest ranking Jewish member of the government, he came out and he had very harsh things to say. And I said that this is going to open up the door for a lot of other people to come forward. Now, AOC is officially in Congress calling it a genocide, even though people tried to frame it like she never said it beforehand, even though she did. But it's not doing it on a news interview in the floor of Congress. Two different things. You know, people who criticize her are so weird. It's like they think that she doesn't like Ukraine when she supported Ukraine. She also like was like the October massacre. She like wasn't like pro Hamas after that, you know, even though they try to say that she was. And then also she was also like calling out the atrocities in Gaza from the start. It's like, what more do you want from her? Netanyahu wants to finish what they started, aka kill all the Palestinians in Gaza. Because, like, I don't know how effective it's like. People will say this about the Taliban, like, we almost had them in like 2004, but they lightened up and they were able to regrow. You know, they're gonna say the same thing about this. I don't know. We'll see what happens. We'll see if he invades Rafah or not. If he does, we'll see what the United States does. But either way, not good for the election. Am I right? What else do we have? Turkey. I mean, I did mention in Turkey and the EEZ. I mean, Turkey's in this region, right? They basically strengthened relations with Iraq, the government of Iraq. And I was like saying, like, what is it actually going to change? And what it is actually is going to change is allegedly the Iraqi military might cooperate with Turkey to fight the PKK. And if we're talking like Golden Division going out, that's one thing. But if we're talking about like the PMF, yeah, if the PMF ends up like helping, that's like weird, you know, considering like what the PMF is. Anyway, they're moving up actions against the PKK, and people, my contacts inside both Syria, and we're talking like Idlib and the Kurdish side of things, both of them think that a Turkish invasion is coming. And obviously the guys in Idlib don't really care about that. For them, that's like a victory because then they can just expand and have more territory, you know, and backfill what Turkey does. Because obviously things aren't great between the two sides of northern Syria or the, you know, north and south as matter as that. But there's also obviously PKK's main base is in Iraq. Turkey has been doing these claw operations, you know, where they go in and they've been bombing some of the tunnels. A lot of people in Ukraine actually have been, not a lot, but I know many people who are now in Ukraine who were digging tunnels for the PKK not long ago. And they went back to, and then they went to Ukraine, and then they'll go back to, like, they'll do an off season when winter hits in Ukraine, they'll go dig tunnels in Iraq that wait out the winter, basically. A lot of the people with like anarchist collective stuff. So, that's about it. The fact that it is in Kurdistan, and Kurdistan is like even before the Iraq war, it was recognized as like an autonomous state. So Iraq's military is not supposed to be able to go in there. That's part of the constitutional agreement with them, that it must be handed over to the Peshmerga. Now, that's where it gets interesting, because then it's like, what if then the Peshmerga end up having to be pushed to fight the PKK? Because there are factions of the Peshmerga that don't like them, because it's complicated. We don't want to get into it. There's two Iraqi Kurdistans, there's two Libyas, there's two Yemens, okay? There's three Somalias. What else do we have here? Hong Kong. Hong Kong has further tightened its security laws with the passing of Article 23 in a unanimous vote. Wow, crazy. Unanimous, you say. Adding dozens of new crimes with sentences as harsh as life imprisonment. The bill raises punishment for treason and broadens state secrets to include economic or scientific development within Hong Kong or mainland China. What does that mean, Jack? That's your cue. Go ahead, explain this along.
It's fucking gobbledygook. It just means that they can arrest you for fucking anything that they want. That's all it is.
It means
like,
that
literally publishing anything on the economics business, of Hong Kong.
Yes. If they consider your business to be treasonous, they can take down your entire business, basically.
Mm-hmm. And if you have a transitioning flight between, let's say you fly from America to Japan and you have a stopover in Hong Kong and they don't like you, say later, you're in jail for life.
Also, the scientific development, obviously, you know, like World Health Organization, they have to share their results, right? So if that isn't first audited by the CCP, treason now, basically.
Yeah.
This bill specifically targets treason, insurrection, sabotage, endangering national security as external interference in Hong Kong affairs. I don't know. It's just still gobbledygook to me because it's like, what does this even mean?
It literally means nothing. Like, it's nothing. It's we made shit up so we can arrest anybody that we
10
want.
Years of hatred. 10 years, if they accuse you of hating the CCP, you'll be jailed for 10 years. Epic. You know, another commie land country. Just kidding. There's protests in Cuba that's over food shortages. I don't know in how many years, but it's one of the biggest migrations of Cubans, which, you know, people are worried about the Haiti migration, which, by the way, we have a special in Haiti. If you want to learn more about Haiti, we just released. But people are like, oh, they never talk about the Cubans coming, right? Where they talk about these illegal immigration people, because they know Cubans vote right wing. So you never hear anything about them being displaced. You never hear anything about floods of Cuban migrants, do you? You wouldn't know, you're not from here. So the government in Cuba just basically said, we see you, we hear you. This is what we're going to do. We're so transparent. This is literally what happened. And like, they could just be like, okay, we're just going to bow down and dissolve the government and then the U.S. will lift sanctions. There is like a quick solution, but come on, let's be realistic about the situation. That's just being like, Hamas, surrender, because Palestinians will stop dying. That's not how government works. I think everyone is of the opinion that the embargo is stupid, except for, I guess, the Republicans, because they want to displace Cubans because they vote Republican, maybe. I don't know. How far into this do we want to get? The embargo is said to be largely to blame. At least that's what the Cuban government is blaming. But Obama wanted to relax the embargo. There's a great speech of him talking to actual Cubans. I think they're like first generation Cubans, or they're kids of first generation Cubans, but talking about what he's going to do and how the next admin has to pick up the ball. Well, obviously Trump did it. He made it worse than ever. And basically Biden came in and didn't change anything, because as I said earlier, you tend not to change things from the foreign policy. And on a hilarious note, in the same kind of region, Bolsonaro, former president of Brazil, is facing jail time for lying about his COVID vaccine status. So when he did his little Jan 6th thing where they were going to occupy government buildings, it was very funny because basically the security department just let the people come in and then surrounded them and sieged them and arrested all of them. But Bolsonaro went to Florida at this time. They like spotted him at a grocery store and all this stuff, and people were like, oh, he's in Florida because he thinks it doesn't implicate him for this coup type thing that he's doing. That was like another failed Jan 6 coup, because he loves Trump. He's just like Trump. Except Bolsonaro, when he got stabbed, he bled. I think Trump would leak a goo. So yeah, he lied about his vaccination status, which is funny because if anyone has gotten like more COVID more times than Bolsonaro, I don't know if they exist. That man is always in the hospital with a new case of COVID. He's gotten every variant. Then on top of that, he's also going to be, well, it says facing jail time. I think they recommended criminal charges, to be specific. They might be going forward with them. And then there's also, this is so funny because it's like Trump, but stupider, because he also has legal things from his bad presidency, basically. The other thing is that not long ago, he was riding a jet ski too close to a whale. So it's illegal to harass that whale. So he's also going to be doing he's going to also be going to court for harassing a whale as well, which is like a serious felony. And to finish up something very short, Bosnia and Herzegovina has moved forward to session negotiations on its path to EU membership. The EU has wanted the Western Balkans inside their union for a while, but only Croatia has advanced so far. This is a positive step forward for Bosnia and a marker to show that the country has advanced to a point where the EU is genuinely considering their candidacy right now. I've also heard rumors that Armenia has expressed interest in joining the EU. I don't know how serious that is being taken, But if it's really funny because they can't let Turkey in because they're just too big, right? It just screws up the EU. So if Armenia got let into the EU, but I think the Armenians are more of, they're just pushing for it because they know Russia isn't going to keep them safe. So along with them moving closer to the US, they're also trying to move closer to the EU in whatever way they can. Armenia and NATO would be really funny too. That would be really funny. Anyway, let's talk about this terrorist attack in Russia. Terrorist attack. And the first thing you see is, like, the first reports were just a guy with a machine gun. Then we saw a pair of people, right? And that's like early, like the first 10 minutes I saw a pair and I'm like, this is ISIS. The mimetic type of terrorism, like the Christchurch shooting, doesn't happen in pairs. You know, when has a mimetic mass shooting happened in pairs ever? Columbine, that's the first one, you know, they started the trend. So
I don't know. I've only seen the videos. I haven't looked much into it because I'm waiting.
I mean, well, it's just ISIS claimed responsibility.
Yeah.
A lot of people are like,
over 100 dead.
Yeah. Why? Yeah. Over 100 dead. And people were asking, like, why is ISIS attacking Russia and stuff? And so the Khorasan division, aka like the Pakistani Talibani division of ISIS, they are from the Caucasus to Afghanistan. They're huge. So people from all those territories fall under the command of that. So this is a problem that really situates in Tajikistan. Well, we don't know specifically yet, but some of the guys we believe, you know, if we are to believe what Russian evidence says and who the arrests are, we'll see after a fair trial, maybe, that they're Tajik, a few of the guys. And the others were from basically a caucus republic, you know. The Caucasus all broadly want to be independent from Russia. It's not just Chechnya. Now, this is an issue with the Tajik government. They are extremely secular. The big terrorist group that was like, it was like the Haqqanis, Al-Qaeda, and then the Uzbek movement, which was largely Tajik and Uzbek movement, right? So these were like three big groups when the war on terror started. And that Uzbek movement has largely become ISIS-K, which even encompasses the Uyghurs, right? Uyghurs are also in this group if Uyghurs go to ISIS. So some of these guys, like, there's like, this started in Syria. So like these guys fought in Syria, they started in Syria, like it develops all through this Russian imperialism into Muslim territory. And ISIS is able to appeal to a lot of these people because, much like Al-Qaeda, you know, they get results. So the United States warned Russia there was an attack. I remember people were like, oh, so obviously, how come the Americans are saying an attack is going to happen? Russia said it was to delay their elections, to fuck with their elections and stuff. So they told all American citizens in the country to avoid crowds, large crowds, and then this attack takes place. It was a pretty insane attack. Not since there's the shooting in France way back in the day where it was gunmen opened up on the street in France.
Yes.
And the emergency exits being locked in some of the places, like, really, I'm sure. Oh, they still did have mags with ammo left too, because the gun must have broken, right? The way it was sparking.
Yeah, it looked like it. Yeah.
So
maybe,
like,
the gas tube exploded.
That's what I thought happened. It looked like there was a gas malfunction with how the gun was going. But this is a serious ISIS attack, and it's funny because, like, ISWAP kills way more people weekly. But you never hear about them because they're in Africa, you know. When it's white people who die, then we hear about it.
Of course.
This is a problem that really lies with Russia's treatment of its citizens in the Caucasus, and also former Soviet states and how they've treated their people, that have led to these radicalization paths of these people. Much like how a lot of OG ISIS had a lot of English people in there because the English were just awful to the Pakistanis who were basically like coming into their country for a long time. There's a lot of Pakistani migration there. Anyway, I guess that's that.
Okay, so this one's going to be a little bit long-winded, but the context is necessary. So Boeing is one of America's biggest companies. They produce military equipment, obviously, but most people know them for their commercial jets. Recently, their commercial jets have been falling out of the sky, and overall, the quality of the jets has plummeted. Airbus, the commercial European competitor to Boeing and the only other commercial jet producer, released a more fuel-efficient version of its plane, the A320, called the Neo. This caused a panic at Boeing, and they made a promise for something that they didn't have. They said that they would make a fuel-efficient version of their 737, and they said it would fly the exact same as the old planes. This was one of their biggest mistakes. To ensure this, Boeing went to existing customers in an effort to undermine Airbus and to retain business, making these promises that they had no idea if they could keep. The planes would fly the same, thus not require any retraining, and they'd give them a nice little discount too on top of it. This was all to retain business from these airlines. I think American Airlines was one of the biggest ones. The sheer idea of losing money to the competitor because they hadn't upgraded their planes to be more fuel efficient seemingly drove the company insane. To hold on to these promises, and because the plane behaved completely differently to the original 737 due to where the engine placement was, they looked around the company and found a neat little system called MCAS. They use it in fighter jets to right the planes after high speed maneuvers. It would automatically adjust the stabilizers at high speed. They wanted to apply this to commercial jets, and to incorporate this, they increased its potency to adjust for the speed differences, because obviously fighter jets are pulling these maneuvers at multiple, you know, speed of sound, faster, twice the speed of sound sometimes. You don't need much adjustment there. So they made it more powerful. And it's a very important part to note. So come production and delivery of the 737 MAX jets in May of 2017, Boeing seemed to have everything nailed. Everyone was happy. The planes were flying. Come October 2018, Lion Air Flight 610 took off, and it was in a 737 MAX 8. It crashed into the sea 13 minutes later, killing 189 people on board. Boeing blamed the pilots. It turns out it was the MCAS system that I mentioned earlier. Because it was roughly four times more powerful than any fighter jets. It was thrown off by an angle of attack sensor, which made it nosedive into the ocean. The key thing to note about the angle of attack sensor is it's the only sensor that it uses. And it can be disturbed by pretty much anything. Any sort of disruption. So, very, very cool. Yeah.
Planes hit birds all day, every day. Planes are hitting birds.
Mm-hmm. Always. So, yeah, very cool. Not even a year later, Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 crashed near, I can't say that, after just 6 minutes of flight time. Once again, the plane's MCAS system was triggered, causing a nosedive following the crash. The company once more blamed the pilots for the crash. So let's talk about them. The pilots, Jared Getachew, 29, had been flying for 9 years. Half of his flight time was on the 737. And the 2IC, the junior pilot, 25, recently passed the academy, the airline academy, and had almost two-thirds of his very limited flight time. I believe it was around 320 hours, which is not a ton, but two-thirds of it was on this plane. When they experienced the MCAS system malfunction, I guess you could call it, within two minutes of the takeoff, the plane went into an unrecoverable nosedive, impacting the ground and killing all 157 people on board, totaling 346 people killed by Boeing's cost-cutting solution to competition. When the black box for this flight was recovered, it revealed that the two pilots did everything that they were trained to do. They disengaged the MCAS, they took manual control, and they tried to right the plane. It also revealed that they were attempting to save the lives on board while it bled pull up at them until the very last second. And Boeing still had the nerve to blame them for this crash when it's their system that was defective and killed 350 people. The Ethiopian Airways flight prompted a global grounding of the MAX planes.
So specifically with this crash, right?
Mm.
What happened is so it's not that they like slept on it at all. They immediately recognized that it was an air being due to MCAS, right? Because it had just happened. They were like aware and trained for this eventuality. So when they override the MCAS and pulled up, and like you said, like this is takeoff, right? So on takeoff already, they were at a speed that was already too high going to the ground where it couldn't be recovered. So even if like it automatically kicked off like right when MCAS triggered anything, just because MCAS triggered on takeoff, the plane crashed. There was no way to recover it.
Where are we? Okay, so in 2021, so after these flights, after all of the groundings, Boeing eventually settled to pay $2.5 billion for fraud after investigations revealed they had intentionally hid the potential issues that they knew about of the MCAS system from the FAA, as well as working with the FAA to get it removed
from the pilots,
from
too.
Instruction manuals, and hid it from the pilots, yes. All because they didn't want to retrain the pilots in simulators. And they got a nice little $1 million bonus on top because they were $1 million cheaper. So very cool. With an additional $1.8 billion in damages to customers and $500 million in crash victim funds, the MAX jet slowly returned to service, and once more everything seemed fine until 2024. Alaska Airways flight lost its door plug after the four bolts meant to be holding it in place were in fact never put in. The plane was only 2 months old at the time.
Can I just explain what the door plug is real quick?
Yes.
So in the fuselage, like they stamp them, you know, they cut them out on the machinery that make the fuselage. So normally there is a door here on other models, but because this model didn't have a door there, they just engineered a plug for that. So it's just a panel that staples onto where the door should be that looks like a regular piece of the plane. You wouldn't notice the difference. And the four bolts that are supposed to secure it on just weren't there. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, so the plane was only 2 months old at the time of this incident. This also once more caused another round of airworthiness checks and further grounding of the Boeing fleet. There was also a whistleblower that came out called John Barnett. He came forward raising safety concerns within Boeing's manufacturing facilities. It came out that Boeing employees were unsure about their role in the safety and feared reprisal if they brought it up. The whistleblower was then found dead of apparent suicide, curiously. And finally, the most recent update for Boeing, a 737-800, a non-MAX aircraft, had a fuselage panel fly off in mid-flight, only realizing it after they had landed. It was also revealed that instead of spending money on planes and safety, Boeing spent company money on stock buybacks after they merged with McDonnell Douglas to artificially inflate their stock value. Between the two crashes that I mentioned before, instead of patching the issue like they said, they authorized $20 billion in stock buybacks, and then another plane crashed. So that's pretty cool. As I said, the FAA is also implicated on this. Regulation and safety checks for Boeing were done by people technically employed by the FAA, but they were paid by Boeing. So realistically, they're Boeing employees. They had zero oversight. And this was set up at a time to like limit time spent between calling out for a quality check and time traveling to the manufacturing facility. So they would station someone in the actual facility. This was meant to be a shortcut in a way to streamline everything. It just turned into a way that Boeing could cheat the system and cut costs and get away with it until people died. So yeah, this clearly had zero oversight. Clearly it's run wild and probably needs to be revoked and replaced with something that's maybe a civilian oversight committee.
Oh, that's a really good idea. A civilian oversight committee. But like, just like,
that would
be
a way better idea.
You know, lobbyists for Boeing were involved with getting the government, Congress, to vote on this FAA thing. But you know, this East Palestine crash, right? the one of the things that they blame for the cause of that is because if they kept shortcutting the safety checks, right? Because they were like, oh, you can safety check those cars faster. Why? Because companies merged and shit, right? And we were joking earlier that literally, like, China might have better airplanes and air safety than the United States at this point.
Yeah.
At least they grounded Boeing before America did, the FAA mandated the groundings. So go China. China victorious over USA.
China number one. Singapore and shit.
So yeah, if you don't know, there's a uncut version on our Patreon that's been up for a few weeks now. There's going to be uncut versions going up to the Patreon. Basically, whenever they're done, I'll put them up there. And then because it takes us a while to get organized to write stories with streaming and stuff like that. I think this one is probably one of the most impactful. Like, you think, like, how much does Singapore impact me? The material and education in this one and how much it relates to the U.S. and how this is completely tied into the problems inside our government as well is going to, like, probably change how you look at the political landscape and how you look at American politics. Like, it will make you aware of things that you weren't aware of before.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire, and that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own, any institution but our own.
Hi, I'm Alex, do them. I'm from Singapore.
Hi, I'm Carissa, or Carrie for short, she, her pronouns. I'm also from Singapore.
I think it'd be good if you could talk about the Christian far right in Singapore, as well as state vulnerability in Singapore's context, because these form two of the main ruling classes, ruling elites, in the public / private / intersection of the public and private sphere within Singapore.
Singapore is, like, held up as, like, being, like, one of the greatest countries in the world. How do you feel about that?
I would say that people want a myth they can believe in, and Singapore is a convenient myth that I think everyone wants to believe is doing well, because you look at the rest of the world, you've got so many other countries, so many other cities that are not doing well. People look at Singapore on the surface, and I think this is a very carefully curated kind of appearance. This is a very carefully curated kind of reputation, but behind a lot of that impressions, a lot of reputation management requires a lot of resources, and we are talking about public resources, obviously. We are talking about the people's money at the end of the day being spent to prop up this kind of reputation, to prop up this kind of appearance, right? So the reality is a lot messier and a lot less straightforward than it seems, lah. And I think that's a lot of where some of the political and economic history of Singapore is going to come in relevant here.
Yeah, a lot of this has to do with Singapore currently being a major finance hub and attempting to be a major tech hub as well.
Singapore always sounds like a cyberpunk city to me, you know? And it's like, anytime you look at cyberpunk fiction and just, like, how the crime works and things like that, it just always seems like that's based on that Singapore.
I've heard that there is a massive wealth disparity in Singapore. Like, there's barriers to entry for going up in class. How elaborate is this? And
definitely,
can you expand a little bit?
Yeah, so a lot of the trajectories to enter into the, like, public office and that sort of, like, elite strata starts from very young, because how education works in Singapore is very, it's kind of like a pyramid, and there's kind of like a lot of path dependence. So how you get into primary school is through certain criteria, including where you live. And what this kind of means is that there's a particular stretch of elite schools in this neighborhood called Bukit Timah in Singapore. And that's a very wealthy neighborhood. You don't have public housing there the way that you do in the rest of Singapore. So if you live in that neighborhood, that means you get access to these like primary schools. And once you get access into these primary schools, it's easy for you to move into the secondary schools because of, like, this filtering system in which once you're in a certain primary school, you kind of get fed into a secondary school with, like, lower grades. You don't have to qualify as much. And this kind of spills over all the way to, like, junior college and even eventually university, because you get a lot of resources being pumped into these schools. You meet a lot of, like, elites. Lee Kuan Yew, who was basically, like, the founding father of Singapore, very much believed in elite socialization, very much believed that elite people should get married and have elite children, and rolled out things like the graduate mother scheme, in which he was promoting that if you're like a graduate mother, you would get rewards for having children, compared to like sterilization of like more lower income women during that period of time too. So the kind of like elite formation trajectory is very much intergenerational and very much easy to access once you kind of float down a certain stream of things from when you're really young. So that's kind of how I will start.
How this plays out really, I guess, is the fact that you've got a large working class population in Singapore, as within any other country in the world, but there's this whole myth that there's this whole socialization, I guess, especially from state institutions and other institutions, to condition most working class folks in Singapore to believe that we are middle class people in Singapore and state. And a lot of that whole middle class consciousness comes from this myth of mobility. It comes from this idea that, you know, there's always going to be upward mobility. So long as you work hard enough, so long as you check all the boxes, you do everything that is expected of you, you are going to climb the ladder. You're going to be able to. The reality is very different. I think the people of Singapore can see for ourselves that stuff like, for example, our housing prices are skyrocketing, our cost of living is skyrocketing, but our paychecks are not exactly skyrocketing. I always describe the middle class as a fictitious class.
Would you say it's accurate to describe Singapore as an authoritarian democracy?
Well, I mean, I would say that Singapore is on one hand an authoritarian state, and on the other hand, in terms of its democratic structure, it is what I call a consultative democracy. The real power does not vest in our representative institutions, and obviously we don't have like direct democratic institutions in Singapore. The real power in Singapore rests in government consultation bodies. They're basically designed to act as a bridge between the government and the citizenry, but in practice, a lot of it is basically when you have this whole consultative democracy kind of system, which actually predated representative democracy, if you look at the history of democracy in the world, right? Because if you talk about, say, for example, back when your absolute monarchies in the world were transitioning into constitutional monarchies, before we had like parliaments and congresses and stuff like that, a lot of that kind of like decision making was like, okay, we're going to devolve it to a legislature, which only has advisory opinion. But at the end of the day, it's still very much like the ruling elite has the final say, has the final discussion to decide which of these will take into account. But in Singapore, of course, it's a bit interesting because they take into account selectively based on what is politically expedient for them to take into account. Which, to be fair, I guess is every ruling elite in the world as well. But you also have the other layer where, because it's a lot easier for it to look like it's more responsive in Singapore because we are smaller, because we are more, we have a higher population density. But the converse of that is that these organizations, because most people don't understand that they are the seat of power in the Singapore political system, in the Singapore political landscape, the people who do understand that reality and are politically mobilized enough, such as the Christian far right, take advantage of that and make it a point to use, actively cultivate, I guess, these so-called grassroots organizations to kind of lobby through these consultative channels, consultative bodies, for their own policy agenda of the government. And that is, in fact, where you get to the matter of Operation High Tide, basically.
I mean, we were just leading to Operation High Tide. Do you want to just basically describe what that is?
Operation High Tide is a plan by the Christian far right that aims to essentially criminalize being trans in Singapore, such that anyone suspected of having gender identity disorder, as they like to call it, can be put in an asylum. So Singapore's main like psychiatric hospital is the Institute of Mental Health. That's our primary one. It has origins as an asylum, even though it's been restructured and revamped over the decades. And what this means is obviously that anyone who gets suspected of being gender non-conforming, or anyone really, could fall under this potential institutionalization.
It's kind of almost like a omen of what they kind of are basically trying to do. There's something they call it like Project like 2025, and it's like their plan if Trump gets elected. You know, it's a lot bigger than just LGBT, but it's the whole like crackdown and shift towards like a Christo-fascist state.
Yeah, and that mirrors here because there are links between the US right and the Singaporean far right. Like some of the megachurch leaders in Singapore, such as Lawrence Kong, have met with their US counterparts since like the 80s or 90s to discuss things. They go for conferences, and they can't afford to go to these conferences because they have the money to travel, they have the money to network, they have the time, space, resources, So this kind of ties back to a bit of like the history of the Christian landscape in Singapore. So essentially in 1987, there was an operation known as Operation Spectrum, which is also nicknamed the Marxist Conspiracy, in which a bunch of Catholic social workers and other activists got detained under the Internal Security Department, which is basically Singapore's FBI, I suppose. They're our intelligence agency. So they detained these people who weren't even actually Marxists, but they were kind of like digging a bit into liberation theology, especially this one person called Vincent in particular. So there was a whole show about that because they were made to confess on camera about how, yes, they were part of a Marxist conspiracy that was trying to subvert the state, which a lot of them, after the fact, told the public, actually, we had to confess because we were being subjected to horrible conditions while in confinement, including freezing room temperatures, including literally being slapped across the face. So what this did to the Christian landscape is that it basically wiped out and also scared anyone who was remotely Christian progressive or Christian left-wing or even liberal, honestly, like liberal left. And so then you have a power vacuum in that space. And in that power vacuum, the Christian was able to occupy that and skew the landscape towards the right. In the entire of Singapore, we only have one explicitly LGBT affirming church. Most of the Christian rhetoric is very much still rooted in like very colonial logics of like saviorism. So the way they talk about disability, the way they talk about migrant labor, they don't have that colonial consciousness at all. It's very right wing. That's basically it on my end.
I'm not gonna, I guess, add into that a bit. So I think crucially, a lot of where that shift comes in is you look at, because I think if you look in the 50s and 60s and 70s in Singapore, while by the 70s you did have like some of this like kind of like Christian far right kind of like Christian nationalist evangelical kind of thing coming to Singapore, by and large Christianity in Singapore was actually quite either apolitical or progressive leaning. That was the more dominant trends at that time. It was only after Operation Spectrum in 87, right? And then in the 90s, you get a lot of that. And Operation Spectrum had a geopolitical context. Sure, the government was talking about it as if it was, oh, this Marxist conspiracy kind of thing. But in reality, if you read the interviews by then Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew, he would mention he's not even after the people he detained. The people he detained, he admits they're just a bunch of innocent do-gooders. That's how he sees them, right? Who are the people he was after? He was after the four leaders of the Catholic Church in Singapore at the time. And he was after them because he was concerned. He was looking at what's happening in the Philippines at the time. I think this was the Marcos regime. And after it fell, you know, with the kind of revolution there. And he was looking at that and he was like, we can't afford to have this happen in Singapore. Here's the very strange thing. Because in the next couple of years, Lee Kuan Yew will admit that the Christian fight taking over Singapore is a problem for Singapore. But ironically, by allowing for Operation Spectrum and calling for Operation Spectrum, he created the conditions for them to take over in Singapore. And so subsequently, when he says, yeah, you know, we can't afford to let them take over the government, by then it's a bit too late, right? So because you really get a situation where I think in the 90s, a lot of the shift came from two things. On the one hand, you have this, I guess, contrast between, the big battle was really between liberation theology versus dominion theology, which is a lot of, dominion theology is a lot of what the Christian far right subscribes to, this whole like seven mountains mandate kind of thing. We'll go out there and dominate every sphere of society.
There are seven molders of culture, or seven world kingdoms. He who could take those kingdoms could take the harvest of nations. The religion mountain, education, family, government, media, art, and business. Now these seven fields of influence are very powerful, so powerful in fact, that he who occupies the top of those mountains can literally shape the agenda that forms nations.
It shows in the names of some of the conferences and some of the events that they host in Singapore. You have this thing called Kingdom Invasion, literally, right? So you have some of these things where it's very in your face, lah. And that comes back to Operation High Tide, right? Because you have this thing whereby they have basically authored a 28-page document titled The Christian Solution to the Transgender Question. Like, you can't get more blatant than that. You can't get more in your face than that. I don't think I have to spell it out to our audience. So, and tying that back to the 90s, right, tying that back to a lot of what was happening, the big shift that was happening at the time was Singapore was becoming a supposedly, you know, developed country, so-called first world country kind of thing. And that was 90s, was right after the Reagan administration and the Thatcher administrations in the US and the UK, right? So you have a lot of that. While Reagan's administration was not like explicitly Christian far right per se, but he rode that wave into office. And he found himself very much beholden to that lobby. They call it the moral majority kind of lobby in the US, right? And that has directly influenced Singapore a lot. And this ties in next to, of course, the class factor, which is that at the end of the day, the 90s was also coinciding with when the Christian demographic in Singapore was becoming more affluent. So as it was becoming more affluent, then it shifted away from this whole, like, you know, let's not focus on, like, liberation theology. Let's not focus on, like, you know, like, uplifting the poor and the marginalized and the working class folks. Let's focus on, you know, like, stuff like, oh, there's this whole prosperity gospel kind of thing, more like capital accumulation. Let's focus on, like, you know, dominating the marketplace, dominating culture, dominating society kind of thing. Let's focus on controlling the public sphere, basically. It shifts a lot towards that. And that has an inexorable connection to Singapore, to Singapore's Christian demographic by then, becoming a lot of Christianity by then being seen as the religion of the affluent. This was not always the case. If you look at 50s, 60s, that was definitely not the case. But by the 90s, by the 2000s, you really had that. And I think if you look at the 2000s especially, you have many very naked attempts by the Christian far right to take control of various, like, aspects of the public sphere. Especially if you look at in 2006, there was this conversion therapy focus group called Liberty League, which actually got a $100,000 grant from the National Volunteer and Philanthropy Center, right? And I think NVPC, right? But if you actually look at the grant giving criterion at the time, it did not even fulfill that the NVPC's own criterion. And the NVPC, by the way, is a government affiliated body. So it did not even fulfill that criterion to begin with. And this is taxpayer money we're talking about. $100,000 in 2006, right? Given to this organization that was going out there and basically telling people, trying to basically condition people to detransition. In 2009, was it? I think 2009, there was this Singapore's leading gender equality and, like, feminist organization known as AWARE was almost taken over successfully by a group of Christian far-right leaders from this church called Church of Our Savior in Singapore. And this became a national issue. This became a national issue after that, because even the Singapore Deputy Prime Minister had to step in and chip in on that, right? And there was this whole backlash after that against them for their attempted takeover. But what you have is a situation whereby in the next decade, just because they ultimately were thwarted in the attempted AWARE takeover, colloquially in Singapore we call it the AWARE saga, just because they were thwarted in that in the end, which, by the way, is thanks to the hundreds of people who showed up during that particular, like, general meeting and stuff. In the next decade, the Christian far right did not magically disappear. They did not just say, okay, you know, we lost this time around, we're going to take a retreat. Of course, they consolidate. Of course, they rebuild. Of course, they figure out how to penetrate, especially in more subtle ways into many organizations. Although, frankly, it wasn't very subtle either, like, if you really look at the public record of what's going on. Because they are very upfront about some of the kind of, like, goals they have, and especially I think one recurring phrase you hear a lot with the Christian far right in Singapore is describing Singapore as the Antioch of Antiochs and the Antioch of Asia, like trying to make Singapore this whole, like, hub, this whole beacon from which, like, Christianity spreads in the region. But obviously it's their own brand of Christianity. And on the ground, when you talk to people, you will hear from a lot of Christian, like, very, like, especially, like, mega churches, especially, like, fundamentalist evangelical kind of spaces, that a lot of the kinds of talking points they have are borrowed directly from US context. You will not see a counterpart like that in Singapore. For example, they will cite this, like, not birthday cake, I think wedding cake or something, but they will cite some of these examples from the US that are very much US specific context that have no apparent relevance in Singapore, because even Singapore's political and legal climate is very different from the US. But they will cite these things a lot in talking points in Singapore, and that's kind of really where you will see a lot of that direct borrowing. It's not borrowing, basically, it's just direct copy and paste basically.
Yeah, and also the gay birthday cake thing is basically arguments such as, oh, do we have the right to decline looking after or, like, providing a service to, like, gay couples who want to potentially get a photo shoot or want to potentially order a wedding cake? I mean, gay marriage isn't legal in Singapore. In fact, we just repealed this, like, British colonial law, 377A, which essentially banned, like, anal sex. We only repealed it last year. Wait, last year? 2022? 2022? Right, it was passed in Parliament 2023, right, time. But yeah, with regards to the Antioch thing, that's actually specifically prophesized by Billy Graham, who was, I think, advising Nixon about Vietnam and was, like, encouraging Nixon to, like, bomb Vietnam.
And you see, of course, Hitler didn't, they had a stranglehold on Germany, on the banking of Germany, on everything in Germany. And they had the whole thing, you see, but he went about it wrong. But this stranglehold has got to be broken, or this country is going to go down the drain.
You believe that?
Yes, sir.
Boy, I can't ever say it, but I believe it.
No, but if Hitler elected the second time, we might be able to do something.
So he came to Singapore during one of his like world tours, like his crusades, and I think like hundreds of thousands of people showed up. I'm not sure, but it was a really high number. And he basically prophesized that Singapore was going to be the Antioch of Asia. And since then, there have been articles. Oh, yeah, he drew around 337,000 people over 5 days to the National Stadium in Singapore in 1978. So he prophesied that Singapore is called to be the Antioch of Asia. And since then, they've been like, they basically kind of view Singapore as the gateway to spreading Christianity throughout the region. What Kerry mentioned about how they believe in dominating the marketplace, dominating the education, dominating media, that refers specifically to their Seven Mountains mandate or dominion theology, which essentially identifies seven main pillars in society that require evangelization, essentially, which to me is a form of like patronage. So that's kind of the context. It's very explicit. The links aren't subtle. Even the term moral majority has been used by megachurch leaders in Singapore to essentially say, oh, like 377A should not be repealed because the moral majority is conservative and does not agree to it, when in reality, the majority in Singapore don't actually care. It's inconsequential. What people care about is just minding their own business and getting on with their lives. But you have these zealots, and you have obviously the political religious. Okay, so you have actual fanatics, and you have more politically motivated people in Christian far-right spaces. And they are actually the vocal minority. Statistically speaking, they're less than 20% of the population. They are the vocal minority when they're condemning things like any progress in gay human rights, even. When 377A got repealed, the National Council of Churches in Singapore released a statement, and the statement's phrasing, I'll send the link later, the statement's phrasing essentially felt like it was declaring war, or already perceived the repeal as an act of war against them. So they put themselves in the victim position, essentially.
The story is wild.
What are you reading?
I'm reading the Safety for Singapore website.
Mm-hmm.
This whole story is insane. So do we want to talk a little bit about this?
I just wanted to say it seems like there's not a lot of tension being raised on this and I say this a lot, so like I have friends in Pakistan who are always under threat. Pakistan obviously is never going to do anything to like protect LGBT rights. In America, the shit that we allow, the genocidal rhetoric, the don't say gay bills, those types of things, it just shows that any country elsewhere can get away with it. America's culture influences the laws and crackdowns in all of these countries.
Yeah, like Uganda as well. So there have been like exposés that link the Christian far right from the US to policies that are being made, like homophobic policies that are being made in Uganda and I think Rwanda and stuff. And in fact, Open Democracy, which I think is a think tank, managed to uncover that over 280 million, was it million, Kerry?
Yes, 280 million.
$180 million in
aid organizations.
Yeah.
For five continents, yes.
We know that there was like 50 million channeled into Europe, 50 million channeled into, I think, Africa. We don't know how many have been channeled to Singapore specifically, how much of that money has been channeled to Singapore specifically. But we do know that some of the organizations that the Singapore far right, Christian far right, is tied to in the US are the Witherspoon Institute, Canavox. Yeah, those are the primary ones. So the Witherspoon Institute also got caught up in like scandals for funding pseudoscience about gay parents. I can't find like the webpage right now, but there were like writers from Singapore writing for the Witherspoon Institute's journal. Yeah, like, and they're explicitly from Singapore, so it's very bizarre. Canavox, okay, if you pull open Canavox's website and go to their locations, you'll see that they are literally everywhere. This is Canavox, which is a US-based organization that has connections to the Singaporean Christian far right, particularly through this individual known as Carol Loy. So you scroll down on that page. Singapore has 12 chapters. That's a lot for our size. That's more than they have in like Mexico.
Tiny. Like I was just showing, like Singapore, like technically, if we're going to go by religious minority, Buddhists are the majority there.
Yeah.
They're all in Sydney. Of course they are.
oh, these people. I wonder, because there's that also, like, there's the one Australian group that's linked to the weird church who does the anti-trans stuff in New Zealand. They're in both Australia and New Zealand, but they've both been linked to, like, Posey Parker and stuff. It's like
the all those guys. Yeah.
No. You call that one, yes. You call that one.
Yeah.
This is the Oakland Democracy following the dark money trails.
So do we know what the Christian organizations are called, or is it like all hush hush? We don't really know. The US ones that are funding all this, not the conglomerates and the shady companies and stuff like that. So
I mean, I guess it's a bit complex in the sense that there is quite a bit of investigation done about this, and for what I suppose, some of them are not particularly secret about it either. Although, of course, a lot of it... The tricky part is tracing the whole dark money trails, because obviously those are more harder to document so that people don't catch them for shenanigans, right? But you do have documentation this regardless. And I think as if we're looking at, be it internationally, here there's a list of 28 organizations that are known for being the largest ones that really do a lot of this funding. And in the Singapore context, obviously, I would not be surprised if some of these also do channel funding to Singapore, because Singapore is a very high priority.
Sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say Heritage Foundation specifically here. I believe they are the ones specifically that do the Project 2025.
Yes. 2025, yes, correct. Heritage Foundation and Project 2025, they are, if you tie to, I guess, in the Singapore context, there are specific organizations, both internationally, particularly in the US, as well as in Singapore, which actually are known to, like, it is known where the money is flowing from, because, well, I mean, the Christian Fund is not the most discreet about what they do in Singapore, lah, because they are very upfront about the fact that they want to take over a lot of stuff. I mean, obviously, how they package it in public is obviously a different story, but I think they make no secret about the fact that they have every intention to play a more dominant role politically in the public sphere. So this is actually one of the letters that I actually sent to Singapore's prosecutorial body, and actually including the list of specific organizations that are involved in, like, Operation High Tide. And even this is not an exhaustive, this is not a full list. This is only a partial list. That is a ninth one, but that would be the Faith Community Baptist Church.
Yeah, so Carrie went public about this letter and delivered it to the appropriate authorities, but there have been no updates on how that's going.
Yes.
So you're basically the only one who's probably, like, been public with the organization?
I'm one of the people who has published it openly.
But we're having trouble because I don't think the Singaporean state is prepared to admit just how big a threat the Christian far right is to them, let alone to the public.
Why is that?
Carrie, do you want to explain this?
Well, this gets to the heart of the Singapore's internal security department. I think if you talk to people in the state, on one hand, you have a lot of state capture going on. You do have a sizable number of certain ministries in Singapore that have already been, I guess, dominated, or where the Christian far right is making a lot of headway in some of these ministries. But on the other hand, you have a case where also separate from the state capture, I think most Singaporean civil servants are well aware that the Christian Fund is a threat to Singapore. But what you get is a situation whereby I think whether or not they know how to deal with it is a different story. I would say the vast majority of the civil service and government are not actively trying to abet the Christian Fund, but they feel powerless to take them on because it's like a hornet's nest that nobody wants to kick. On the other hand, when we get to the Internal Security Department in particular, it gets a bit tricky because they are supposed to be the entity within the Singapore government that is dealing with, well, security threats. But what they are in fact doing is a lot of, like, I guess, enabling the Christian far-right and other far-right organizations, other far-right players in Singapore to strategically collaborate with them against their political opponents, like against some of the folks that they see as a greater security concern in Singapore, right? So it becomes quite messy because the Internal Security Department doesn't actually really report to anyone specifically in Singapore. They're not really accountable for all of what they do, as opposed to most other Singaporean public bodies, for example, right? Most of our, like, say, statutory boards or ministries or, like, government-linked corporations, there is a clear reporting line. The Internal Security Department doesn't really have a clear reporting line. Sure, it does have to take permission from the Minister of Home Affairs for certain things, or from the Prime Minister for certain things, but there's a lot of what it does that is very much basically just clandestine operations. because, I mean, on one hand, that's part of their work. On the other hand, what does that actually entail, especially when it comes to far-right extremism in Singapore? Like, that's where I think it really gets messy. Like, because, and it's very rare that people come into contact with a lot of this information, precisely because it's, for the most part, well, not known to the public, because very few people are going to come into contact with the Internal Security Department, although it does have much more of an impact on the lives of most Singaporeans than they would like to imagine that it's the case, right? But I would say this is a once in 50 years fake event in Singapore, but precisely because of the Internal Security Department, I guess, really enabling a lot of these different players to basically use them as like weapons against the people they want to go after, right? Kinds of politically motivated targets they want to go after. And in this rare occasion where one of the players involved does, I guess, reveal quite a lot of this information, I think, precisely because, I mean, they don't necessarily get along very well with their political masters either. So you run into a situation whereby, for the first time in maybe 50 years or so, a lot of this information is available in a way that, say, in a previous era where, I mean, it's not like in the 70s and 80s, people didn't know about the Internal Security Department's shenanigans in Singapore. You had people who were bringing it up, even in our universities at the time, even in our unions at the time, even in our neighborhoods at the time. People talk about these things. It's not like that was not talked about. But that was a very different age. I think right now, especially in this one, like, very digital era and stuff like that, this very online era, you have a lot more of this information that is more easy to get out. It's more easy to, like, spread in circles that would traditionally not have access to this information. And I think that's, yes, correct. Juliet Chin is really one of them, because this was, I think, in 1973, where there was this student in the then University of Singapore who found, I mean, in her own words, right, found herself accidentally elected as the president of the University of Singapore Students' Union, because she went into a particularly chaotic general meeting and was like, hey, you know that we have, like, Internal Security Department, like, agents who are sitting into our classrooms as what they call special students for the purpose of surveillance. And students knew that, and they were not happy about it. That led to a huge outcry where they were like, okay, let's elect this person. She knows what she's talking about, kind of thing. And for what it's worth, the Internal Security Department has compared me to her as well, so you kind of know where this is going. So I think a lot of it is really just, I think a lot of these same old tricks are being reused in Singapore today as well, except that they are now, on one hand, I guess, they use different methods now, because I think politically in Singapore, we have shifted quite a fair bit from the 80s. If the Internal Security Department announced like a mass, like large-scale detention thing in Singapore today, it wouldn't work as compared to in the 70s or 80s. But because a lot of it is in the 70s and 80s, it had that whole like narrative of like Cold War, you know, like this whole like capitalism versus communism kind of thing. They could use that as a geopolitical justification. Today, you don't have that. So a lot of the kind of like detention kind of thing they have is primarily against the Muslim far right, for example, in Singapore. But yeah, and even then, they're not doing a very good job of it. It's primarily just like lone wolves and stuff. But if you look at the kind of methods they use today, I think they have really improvised a lot more from then. Not necessarily improved, but just improvised a lot more from then. But I guess because of this increasingly, I guess, online kind of landscape that we have, some of this information also gets around a bit faster than expected. So of course, people, I think, take a while to familiarize themselves with like, oh, this is the reality of what's going on. But I think it is going further than people expect. And I think Singapore is going to see a reckoning in these areas in the next couple of years to come.
Not much is known about the Internal Security Department, because they are an intelligence agency, but they do originate from essentially British colonial authorities trying to survey the population as means to regulate and control the population. But in the handover from the handover into Singapore's like so-called independence, Singapore's post-independence, that department. So that's yes. That's kind of like why I somewhat compare them to the FBI, but maybe not entirely either, because of that post-colonial.
It sounds kind of Homeland Security.
Right.
Like the Patriot Act came in after 9/11, and all it really did was infringe on American rights. It didn't prevent
yes.
any terrorism.
Yes.
Right. But specifically just now when Carrie was mentioning how the ISD has been trying to target specific individuals who maybe whistleblow or do not comply with them, we have to kind of talk about this other operation known as Operation Providence. Actually, I think Carrie, you should explain this. I'm not good at summarizing.
All right. Now we get to Operation Providence. So a lot of that, I guess, ties into what I mentioned earlier in our introduction, where we talk about the whole retirement adequacy thing, especially after 2008, the global financial crisis. And in Singapore, this applies as well, because in Singapore, we have this thing called the Central Provident Fund, which is basically our retirement savings accounts, because in Singapore, they mandate it as basically like compulsory savings, like compulsory retirement savings, where there's like an employee contribution component and there's an employer contribution component. So it's like, for example, like every month, if your take home pay is, if your gross pay is like, say, for example, 4,000, then you take home about 3,000 and then the 1,000 goes into your CPF account. And then the employer will match that with their own 1,000 into it. So, but you have to hit a certain so-called minimum sum before you're able to unlock that money when you hit like retirement age. And because a lot of people don't actually manage to accumulate to that level, precisely because the CPF account is used for multiple purposes, like for example, spending on like education or spending on like healthcare or housing, for example, especially housing, we talk about like drawing down for public housing purchases in Singapore, right? So you run into this situation where it's very common for Singaporeans to retire without access to their CPF savings in Singapore, right? So that led to this situation whereby I think especially after the 2011 general elections in Singapore, which is in any other country, that would be considered a landslide. That would be considered a landslide victory in any other country for the ruling party. In Singapore, it was a major defeat because they lost 5 additional seats. So and they were caught off guard by that. So that led to this whole reckoning where they looked at it and they went, you know, maybe we need to run a tighter ship on some of these things. And people, and after that, I guess after 2011, people started asking more questions about where is our CPF money? Because that came on the back of the global financial crisis, right? That came on the back of people increasingly finding that, you know, like, on one hand, they can't retire. On the other hand, the kind of investments they have on their own are also being blown up by the Wall Street crash and stuff, right? And in fact, there were protests in Singapore around that time, after in 2009, 2010, about a lot of these, like the whole like mini bond crisis, for example, in Singapore, right? So then now when we get to CPF, right, and I guess a lot more questions were being asked in like 2012, 2013, about like where's our CPF money, because the kind of like these retirement savings funds are tied to our national reserves as well, because that is part of how the government borrows money from the people in order to finance certain things, with the promise obviously that you return it later on. But sometimes what happens if that doesn't always work out, right? So then you run into a situation whereby, in order to avoid answering that question, in order to avoid accounting for what actually happened to that on that front, which in my opinion, it is something that like governments make mistakes all the time. It's something that you can own up, fix the problem, move on. But the Singapore government can't do that because of a lot of the kind of DNA of the kind of people we recruit into government, which tends to be people who have basically only, if I might put it this way, failed upward. They have basically ascended through the system by supposedly making no mistakes at every level, by meeting all the KPIs at every level, such that by the time they get to where they are, it's essentially failing upwards. And so they have never really had to account for like, okay, I screwed up something big before in the public eye. And they get to political office, and those are the people who are elected into political office because those are the people who are ruling party recruits. And by the time they get there, they can't actually handle being scrutinized for these things. And that's where the Internal Security Department comes in. And that's where they come in and say, okay, instead of, and that's why I mentioned this really early on, instead of fixing the problems that our people face, we choose instead to fix up the people who are exposing these problems. And that is what led to this whole Operation Providence thing, where there was this plan to basically frame up one of the opposition politicians in Singapore who was very much bringing up a lot of these questions, because like he's trained as an economist, and while electorally he was not the most successful, he got like 1% in a by-election in 2013, which was the year where they actually started this Operation Providence. But they decided that he was enough of a threat because if he asked too many questions that came too close to the sensitive question of where are our retirement savings, where are our CPF savings, right? A lot of people were going to get concerned. And so the Internal Security Department said, we needed to find someone to accuse him of certain things so that we can discredit him. And at the same time, we are also going to use our own team of people to basically craft threatening messages to him so that he would be, you know, like kind of like intimidated enough and like have his hands tied up enough that he can't focus on running his election campaign and on publicizing a lot of these like sensitive matters that they didn't want publicized. So that led to a lot of the rest of the situation that came after that, right? Operation Providence led to a lot of the rest of the stuff that came after that. And in fact, I will disclose this for the first time publicly, which is that I found out recently that out of the people they were considering as a potential fixer for Operation Providence, the Internal Security Department had long-listed myself as well, which means if history had gone slightly differently today, I would be in the position of like having to deal with the fallout of being used, being framed up for certain things as well. So it is quite, and I think there's quite a bit more to that, because that ties into a lot of how the Internal Security Department gets its manpower from, where it gets the people to both recruit into the department as well as to carry out some of this like third party fixer kind of like operations from. So that gets a bit complicated, and I think if it comes up later we can discuss that, but that is largely a bit of background about Operation Providence.
So we have about 20 minutes left, but anything extra we put on like Patreon and stuff. So if we do go over and talk that stuff, that's fine. Jack, you were looking at the document. Is there anything in there that was like blowing your mind you wanted to bring up?
I mean, the whole story is insane, but I just wanted to, because it says that it's a Christian far right operation. How involved was the government, if at all?
This is referring to which one?
High Tide. All of it? The document
okay.
for safety for
because,
Singapore.
Okay, High Tide is a Christian fire operation. Providence is not a Christian fire operation, despite the name. Okay. It's not, yeah. So there are a few different things where Operation High Tide is led by the Christian fire, but nudged by the Internal Security Department.
So the Internal Security
Department. They don't fully overlap or anything. They don't fully overlap, but sometimes their goals kind of sync up. Carissa, as well as some other targets, such as this person called Harvey, another person called Joyce. Joyce is involved in hacker spaces. She recently delivered a conference in Germany, a hacker conference in Germany, in which she basically... Okay, so there was a whole scandal a few years ago because after COVID, we all got tokens and had to download a mobile app that has like a QR code scanning function. So every time we enter a mall or like a location, we would have to kind of like use the token to mark that we were traveling or like at a certain location so they could do contact tracing. But it was revealed a few years ago that the data for these tokens were also being used to aid certain criminal investigations without like the population's consent. So Joyce recently, in a hacker conference in Germany, did a lecture of sorts in which she basically dismantled the token as well as the safe entry gateways and showed like the engineering process for that. So she's one of the people who the Christian far right and the Internal Security Department are both trying to target. So if one party finds that the other party's method of targeting is suitable and in alignment with their goal, then they're kind of like okay to either let it slide or to sort of help them. Yeah, so this is a diagram that is quite wild. I think the wildest thing about it is that like we have the information at all, which I think throws a lot of people off. But once again, the reason why this information is available to us is very much because at least one of the people who is in contact with the Internal Security Department and/or the Christian far right doesn't necessarily like that they're in contact. So that's how some of the leaks come out.
Yes.
Because you're in a tricky position, right? Because if the ISD approaches you, like the Internal Security Department approaches you and is offering you the carrot and stick, you don't like being in that corner.
Yes.
Yeah, this blends very well into the open source intelligence theme of the show. So
yes,
can we get into like almost like what the call to action, like what do you want from people watching this? How can they help? Like what would you like them to do for you?
Scary, do you have anything?
I'll leave you to ship in first.
I was gonna say actually like more recently, so like corruption happens at multiple levels, and one of the more lower rung corruption levels involves potential corruption by a police officer who's honestly not a major player in this, but he still did misconduct. So if this petition could get signatures, that would be helpful.
Yes. This might get all the signatures before this even comes out, so.
Right. Yeah, no, this doesn't even necessarily like say that he's corrupt. It just simply, because, okay, Singapore has a Corrupt Practices Investigation Bureau, so a CPIB. So there's actually a department for that. And for what it's worth, they do their job when they get to do their jobs. So, but like sometimes them doing their jobs can be blocked. Let's say if the prime minister doesn't want them to like investigate the case further, that could be an obstruction. And they do have the right to go to like the president to override like the prime minister's non-concurrence. But to get to that, they have to be given permission to investigate thoroughly. So this petition basically just calls for them to do their job. It's not anything further than that, actually. Mm-hmm. So a lot of players, as you can tell, a lot of players in this mess. I think looking at the links and like just keeping updated with the situation and talking about it is sufficient. Maybe on the US side, putting pressure or scrutiny on the US Christian far-right organizations involved, like the Witherspoon Institute and Canavox, would help.
There's probably, you know, because I've seen that there's been protests in the US, so anyone who's like close by can probably get involved, like with solidarity events and things like that.
Yeah, yes, for sure.
That would be useful. Yeah.
That would be useful.
Mostly in like California, I'd assume.
One in New York, too.
Oh, okay, awesome. Yeah. Great.
Which I don't know where that is.
Outside the UN.
Okay, so New York.
It's on Instagram though, not Twitter, I think.
Okay,
we'll put all that when this.
It probably would have been Sydney, if that's where all these churches are. It might have been Sydney, but Melbourne is pretty big into this sort of activism
thing. Oh yeah, I think it was Melbourne.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if it was Melbourne. The socialist side of everything, they're pretty active when it comes to protesting. Efficacy is a different story. They don't really do much beyond protesting, unfortunately.
Right. For context, in Singapore, they've also... The thing about this situation is that there have been 3 protests in Singapore about the situation, and protesting in Singapore is illegal.
Really?
Yet, yeah, it's illegal. So even if you just like stand there with a sign as one person, you can get in trouble for that.
That's crazy. That's it's something you don't really think about. Even in Australia, like, I have issues with the way speech is treated in Australia.
But
yeah, even after everything, the facade of free speech is still there. We can still technically go out
and
picket in the street and protest and do all of that stuff. So the mere fact that it's just you can't, period, is just wild. Especially in Singapore, you would think Singapore would be beyond that.
If you click on the Instagram link for Safety for Harvey, you'll see that there have been 3 protests in Singapore, despite it being illegal. And yet, there's been 0 news coverage about it. The media usually covers protests in a negative light. So they will.
Yeah, okay.
So it's kind of like a Streisand effect thing going on, in which like the media refuses to cover any of these protests because that would draw attention, even in a negative way, because that would probably draw attention to the issue itself, like the case itself. And the case is a mess for them to have to even talk
about. Doesn't seem like it's a very good situation. Yeah, so, everybody is clearly doing everything that they possibly can. At the end of the day, you're fighting the state. Yeah,
stuff that we wanted to get into that we didn't yet?
I will say that the state is eating its own tail. Is that the same? Yeah, the state's eating its own tail. Because this isn't good for them either. Having a potential far-right rise to power isn't going to be good for the current ruling party. And the current ruling party has been in government for decades, so not their wisest handling of situations either.
I'm just curious, because I know that I'm pretty sure, I'm not going to say that I know, but I'm pretty sure that Singapore has pretty close ties with China. How is that playing into this? Because the US is, well, I guess US assets are you being used to meddle in Singapore affairs, which could potentially impact China. So I'm just sort of curious about where that sort of sits.
That gets interesting, right? Because I think in Singapore, other than the Christian far right being a major threat to Singapore's national security, the other big national security threat that I think even the state recognizes, and keyword is, when I say they recognize it, it doesn't necessarily mean they know how to deal with it or they are dealing with it. the other big one that they recognize is Chinese foreign interference. Because you have a lot of Chinese foreign influence operations in Singapore. And I'll say that it's a very, it can get a bit counterintuitive at times, because a lot of what the PRC's goals are in relation to Singapore, like, they recognize they can't just like flat out, I mean, they probably could, but they wouldn't do it because it's not worth the risk, lah, huh? They're not just going to come in and like, invade Singapore, for example. But what's going to happen is a lot more taking advantage of Singapore's demographic makeup. Because we are, after all, like, a Chinese majority society, which the Chinese state is very much looking to exploit that. And very much looking for, is there a way we can turn this Chinese majority into a position where they are, I guess, discontented with both the local state of affairs and likely to want to turn to China as an alternative, likely to want to look to China as the someone else they can turn to, right? Because I think the PRC state has been very big about this whole, like, you know, like, Chinese diaspora thing as well. They have been very big about that as well. And
well, in the Singapore context, our last episode is about, like, it was about China, the one that we just released, and he said something there that there's, yes, like, a phrase in Singapore where it's almost like we're Chinese, not Chinese, but it's like talking about the language, but not like the citizenship or something.
Yes. So, basically, it's like, I think, like, at the end of the day, most Singaporean Chinese do not see ourselves as linked or affiliated or supportive of China to begin with. And in fact, there is actually a lot of tension on that front. Because of that, on one hand, I don't think at the moment Chinese foreign interference in Singapore, Chinese foreign influence operations in Singapore have succeeded in shifting people's sentiment on the ground for the most part. You do have pockets of like pro-China sentiment, but it has not succeeded in shifting the vast majority of the sentiment on Singapore. However, and this is where it gets tricky, when we talk about the Christian far right, especially when we talk about the Christian far right in relation to the US, right, in relation to, say, a potential Trump 2024 administration, right, for example, right, you have a situation here whereby if the Christian far right succeeds in Singapore, if the Christian far right takes over Singapore, the fracture within the Chinese population in Singapore becomes a lot more obvious, because a lot of the leaders of the Christian far right are Chinese, but they are primarily affluent, wealthy, upper class, elite, English-speaking, English-educated Chinese in Singapore, right? Whereas a lot of your working class and older generation folks, a lot of your, and especially the more like Chinese-speaking or dialect-speaking Chinese population in Singapore, who are not Christian and not Christian far-right, a lot of them tend to be more working class. And they, I mean, of course, you do have upper class ones amongst those demographics as well, but a lot of them tend to be more working class. And they will feel disenfranchised if the Christian far-right comes to power in Singapore. And here's the thing, on one hand, they're not exactly a minority in Singapore per se, although they're also not the super majority. Like, Chinese as a demographic is a super majority, but it's an artificial categorization. Singapore's ethnic classification system is quite the artificial construct, just like in any other country. I mean, in the US, they have that as well, right? Of course. But in the context of Singapore, what you get is that if the Christian far-right succeeds, the Chinese population is going to be split down the line, and that creates a ripe opening for China to basically take advantage of that and sell to this Chinese-speaking Chinese demographic in Singapore, hey, why not you align yourselves with us instead? Why not you switch your affiliation and align yourself with us instead, right? And that creates an opening. Right? So you have a situation whereby while China doesn't quite care about the Christian far-right for the most part, they do have a vested interest in seeing the Christian far-right succeed in Singapore, because that makes Singapore a lot more exploitable. That makes it such that they can really take advantage of that a lot more.
I mean, that should cover it. That answered my question. Is there any last questions you wanted to ask, John?
No, just might make sure we have everything that we wanted to talk about. Because I figured, like, to talk about like the story of events, I can just like kind of use the website in editing and stuff to show story of events and stuff, and people can read about it themselves. You know, we'll cover stuff that's not exactly online, some extra additional context that's more than like what you can see through the website.
Mm.
You know, maybe what's going on next, like, because this will probably be out, give it like 3 weeks or something, you know, like what do you think is going to be their next move, the next fear that you have or something like that?
Well, that's actually quite a tough question to answer, I would say, right? Because I think I would say that right now Singapore is facing a very strange inflection point, which is in large part because Singapore is intrinsically intertwined with both the regional order in Southeast Asia and more broadly speaking, the Asia Pacific, as well as the international order. And I think geopolitically speaking, we look anywhere else in the world, I think we can see where all the vulnerabilities are. Like. And especially in the region as well. Look at the South China Sea matter, you look at Taiwan, you look at, you know, what's going on in the Middle East, for example, as well. You have a lot of those things, and you look at what's going on in Ukraine, for example, as well. I think Singapore is very much tied to a lot of these things. Singapore is very much tied to a lot of these things. And I think because of our vulnerability as a society, because of the fact that we are small and open, and we are so open that I think what happens in Singapore has repercussions everywhere else as well. For example, if your Operation High Tide in Singapore succeeds, or if any other far-right entity succeeds in taking over Singapore, be it the Christian far-right, be it the Muslim far-right, be it the Hindu far-right, be it even a Buddhist far-right, hypothetically, and you've got any of these religious far-rights, and even your non-religious far-rights, but especially your religious extremist far-right groups, if they manage to take over Singapore, any one of them, you are going to lead to a very rapid destabilization of like the regional order in Southeast Asia, because you have other like religious fundamentalists in neighboring countries as well. Look at Malaysia, you look at Thailand, you look at Myanmar, you look at Indonesia, you know, like you have a lot of these like groups that are gaining ground in some of these spaces as well. And you look at, of course, not too far away, you look at India with like Narendra Modi and the BJP and stuff like that as well, Hindutva, for example, right? And there's a lot of connection between that and Singapore as well, of course. So once you get a lot of, like, if Singapore falls to any of the far-right groups, any of these far-right demographics, we are going to spark off an escalation in the region that when you combine that with a likely already impending, like, imminent, like, South China Sea-related conflict, you are going to get clashes that will happen earlier than I think the world is prepared for. And on the other hand, obviously, because of Singapore's position in relation to, like, say, like the great powers rivalry with like US and China as well, that is going to have quite severe implications on not just in the not just on Southeast Asia and the region, but also on the rest of the world as well. Because especially when we talk about, say, if we're talking about the Christian far-right, that will have ripple effects in connection with the next US government, for example. And that will also obviously implicate China's side as well, because of what I mentioned earlier about what China's vested interest in this matter are, right? So then you run into this other thing whereby I think, which is not to say that we don't have an alternative way forward, because there is definitely a way to avert such an outcome. But that will require Singapore society, I think, to recognize that we have got to reconfigure our direction quite significantly. I'm not sure if the current political leadership has that, I guess, like fully understood on their end. I mean, it's for them to show us that they do have that. I mean, an election is coming in maybe the next 1-2 years or so. So it is up to them to show us that they have got it. But I think so far from the kind of actions you're looking at, it doesn't really inspire a lot of confidence, be it locally or internationally. It's just that I think for the most part, people's narratives about Singapore tend to assume, oh, you know, Singapore is stable, Singapore is prosperous, or people will support the ruling party. There's a lot of political stability in Singapore. But I think at the end of the day, what's going to happen in the next 2 years is going to be quite the shakeup, and I think this is a shakeup that will have implications across all four corners of the world. And I think this is something that we are going to really have to take very seriously, what's going on in Singapore, right? So that is my concluding remarks, I guess I would say. And really, a lot of it is really just, I think, as a society, we have got to think about how to, on one hand, counter far-right extremism a lot more deliberately, a lot more intentionally. On the other hand, we have got to pivot away from the Internal Security Department's current approach of fixing up people rather than fixing problems, right? I think Singapore has got to start recognizing that there are new ways to addressing a lot of these things, but that requires us to really, I guess, take some of the harder decisions to, for example, I guess, realign ourselves in certain regards to kind of like wean off certain dependencies that we currently have, to kind of, you know, like shift towards certain new ways of doing things. And I really think that requires us to address it at every level. This is essentially at a grand strategy level, I would say, right? Because you tie into both our domestic political economy as well as our international political economy, as well as our both internal and external national security. And these are going to be hard choices that we're going to have to make, because the reason they are hard right now is because we have deferred making them for the past 30 years or so, past 30, 40 years or so. And right now, a lot of these consequences are coming back to bite us in the ass, like, to put it that way. But now more than ever, I think, especially when we look at the current outlook of the rest of the world, I think it is crucial that Singapore recognizes, like, that we do have the ability to set a different path forward. We do have the ability to bring a different kind of stability to both locally as well as to the region in Southeast Asia, and that will have implications for the rest of the world as well, because my belief is that Southeast Asia as a region can be a massively stabilizing force for the rest of the world, and it can set a new direction to kind of counterbalance against both the US and China, or even an ascendant India's domination. But that requires, of course, we can't do that with the current ASEAN configuration. We are going to have to really shift the way things are done in the region. And that starts with a country like Singapore, precisely because Singapore is small, Singapore is dense, Singapore is highly governable. A lot of the shifts are a lot easier to affect than Singapore. What that also means is that it's a lot easier for adversaries to affect that. But on the converse of that, it's a lot easier for the people of Singapore to stand up, to actually like affect that on our own part, and to recalibrate Singapore in a way that will be healthier, both for our, I guess, direct material conditions, as well as for the rest of the world, as well as for the world order at large. Yeah.
All right, Alex, you have anything to say before we leave?
On my end, I'm just worried for my friends, and I'm worried for the refugee crises, multiple, that we're going to be seeing for the next few years, as things seem to be moving more right. As things seem to be moving more towards the right, and as borders get tighter, so I'm worried for that, and I hope that more people realize that fleeing isn't always feasible, and sometimes you need to fight back. Yeah.
Yes.
Through the years, America has stood as the world symbol for law and order. Anarchy, well, that was something that was always happening in other countries. Newsworthy, perhaps, but it could never happen here. The policeman on the corner has traditionally been looked upon as a friend, not as the instrument of a tyrant. People in other countries had just reasons to riot against their governments. The nations of the world are dictatorships in one form or another.